The Committee on State Government Innovation and Veterans will be in order. Today is Monday, February 27, 2012. Let the record show we do have a quorum. The first item on the agenda is Senate File 1922, Senator Peterson, State Agency Rules, Review and Reporting Methods, Provisions, Modifications. Members, remember that we are continuing testimony from our discussion that we did have on this bill last Monday. I have a testifier list in front of me from the previous meeting that we need to continue. First, Senator Peterson, I believe you have an amendment to the unofficial engrossment, and I think that's the A4 amendment. Do we have that passed out?
Yes, we do.
Would you like to discuss that amendment?
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. The A4 amendment I have before you, I'll just touch on a few critical points here. The first section relates specifically to language that we took out that referenced some of the testimony you heard about scientific, technical, or economically sound, cost-effective, or restrictive issues that were more restrictive than federal law, and we believe that that's addressed in the SONAR or in the statement of need that the agency used to start the rulemaking process. And then finally, most importantly, the last section, in Section 11, we made some changes there specifically compared to the bill that was introduced. It changes the administrative rule repeal without legislative actions. That's a key. Originally, we had it without legislative action. We've changed it so that the rule repeal is based on the legislative committee review process are the two main points in terms of the changes in the bill, and believe that that is going to put it in a situation where more people can support it on a broad basis.
Senator Peterson, would you like to have Senator Daley move this before we take testifiers?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
All right. Senator Daley.
Mr. Chairman, I move the A4 amendment to the unofficial engrossment of Senate File 1922.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Amendment prevails. We will move on to testifiers. The first one that I have is Greta Gauthier, Government Relations, Department of Ag. Please state your name.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is Greta Gauthier. I'm with the Department of Agriculture, and I have with me also today Bob Meyer from the DNR and Kirk Kudelka from PCA. Mr. Chairman, if the three of our agencies could just kind of outline our concerns in general, we thought that might save time and be more efficient. First of all, I'd like to thank Senator Peterson for the delete all amendment. We did see a major improvement in that the provisions that would have sunset all of our rules at the end of the biennium has been deleted. So that removes a concern that we had with the bill, and we wanted to thank Senator Peterson for that change. We do still have a few concerns regarding this legislation. And I'm going to speak generally about some concerns of all agencies, and then my colleagues will speak about some of the specifics. And I'll also have some specifics pertaining to my department, which is agriculture. First of all, one of the problems would be the cost of preparing the reports, the report that's outlined on page 8, section 11. This report would be due from all five of the agencies listed there, DNR, PCA, Agriculture, Bowser, and the EQB, would be due January 15th of next year. But it would also be required of all agencies at the time of their sunset review. From my standpoint alone, I mean, there is no funding in the bill to cover the staff time that would be required to assemble this. So our concern at the Department of Agriculture is that the 4 to 5 FTEs it would take us to go through all of our rules would have to be people that would be pulled off of their regular duties, whether that's exports or food safety, pesticide and fertilizer, or promoting agriculture and developing new markets. So we would oppose the report from that standpoint of the cost. A second objection we have is that the additional time that's put into place here and the fact that there is already a system in place in Chapter 3 of the statute, I believe it says that anytime two members of the LCC or five members of the legislature request it, any rule can be pulled in and objected to, and there's a whole process outlined for the LCC to become involved in that stage. So we feel that the existing system is already there and does not have a particularly high hurdle in that only two members of the LCC or five legislators would have to request that a rule be brought in under an objection. Also, it's unclear at some point where the LCC process would come in for the proposed rules. Currently, the LCC can object to any adopted rule. This would also allow the LCC to object to any proposed rule or any part of a proposed or adopted rule. And so we're concerned about that from a standpoint of delay, because the LCC could have 30 days to make their objection, and then the agency responding given 15 days, so adding another 45 days to the rulemaking process does not seem to be going in the direction that we would like to see it go, which is moving in a more rapidly, especially since the LCC already has the ability to pull any rule in. And then also I also wanted to touch base on the timing of the LCC intervention. We just be concerned that it not come at a point where during a proposed rule, if we've already had a period for the public to give their input and or an administrative law judge to make a decision based on the public input and the department's response to it, that the proposed rule doesn't get pulled, and we're concerned about the message that might send to the general public about the value of their input. So I guess we're concerned about the whole inclusion of proposed rules from a couple of standpoints, delay and what that would mean for people's incentive to participate in the public input and public review of proposed rules. So in conclusion, I mean, rules were created to protect the public and to provide for public safety, and also to ensure a level playing field. If some of our rules at the Department of Agriculture pertaining to exports, Minnesota is the 6th largest exporting state, even though we're 21st in population. We're 3rd in corn and 4th in soybeans. If our rules are all to be put in a process where they can come under question, I think that sends a message to our international customers, and I think in a way it could be damaging to the Minnesota brand. And I don't think that's something anybody wants to do. We have an existing system and it works well. Also, our food safety rules as well would fall under this, and we also have concerns about maintaining the public's confidence in the food supply, and it's our number one goal of our mission is to ensure the integrity of the food supply. So, again, the rulemaking process on some of these things is extremely technical and very intricate. In fact, it's interesting to note that the Department of Agriculture was created in 1895 in response to widespread illness due to tainted milk. And it was created partially because the legislature realized that they needed to have a lot more expertise on hand all the time to deal with this whole issue of tainted milk, which, of course, pasteurization came along later and solved a lot of those problems. But food law is very complicated, and we think that the current system is working. So with that, I will turn it over to my colleagues, and then all the agencies take questions if that's acceptable to you, Mr. Chairman.
Please state your name and proceed.
Chair and committee members, my name is Kirk Adelk. I'm the legislative director for the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency, and I just want to echo the earlier comments that about our concerns as agencies, but just wanted to use some examples on the existing tools that the legislature has already to review rules and have an impact on it. Currently under Minnesota Statute 3.305, as it was mentioned, the LCC can hold hearings on the rules. This is very rarely done. Although it was done once in 2004 and had, a very productive outcome. We as the MPCA were actually bringing forward some rules dealing with solid waste transfer stations, demolition landfills, and beneficial use and research projects. And through that public hearing on the front end of the process, before a lot of time and dollars were spent by the agency and stakeholders, we came to an understanding that some of the things didn't need to be done at this time or at all. That's the type of involvement that statute already allows by the legislature. We don't understand why there needs to be a bill that, when there are already the tools being out there for the legislature, they're just not using it. So at this point, it would be easier just to use the tools that are already in the toolbox as to look at the rules instead of creating new types of committees and adding on additional government onto it. The second issue is, again, on the front end is where it's important for any stakeholder, whether it's legislators, regulated parties, environmental groups, to have a role into changing how the rulemaking goes about. And that, as a part of that improvement, our agency, along with our assistant commissioner rulemaking staff, have met together with chamber members, local units of government, environmental groups, and others on focus meetings on ways to improve how we do use the current structure in place to create better rules. And so we've identified a number of changes, and again, those are on the front end on the communications between the stakeholders and the agency to get better rules. In summary, we just see that there are a number of things already on the books that can be used to help improve rulemaking, but at this point they're just not being utilized, and that this bill, we have some questions on why the additional things are being added at this point.
You state your name and proceed.
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Department of Natural Resources. Thank you for allowing me some brief comments on this bill. And thank you, Senator Peterson, for the work you've done to date. We do appreciate the changes that are being made. However, we do have some more changes that we would like to see and continue working with you on it. One of those from the department or from the administrative side is the term cumulative effect. I mean, that's a large statement. In page 7, lines 7.7 to 7.8, it would require an assessment of the cumulative effect of the rule with other federal and state regulations and local ordinances. If we're doing a rule for the departments from the DNR on the size of bullheads to be used for fishing, for example, how am I to determine what that cumulative effect may or may not be? So we need to look at that very closely. And just overall, rulemaking from the DNR side is a very public and open process. We have a web page devoted to dockets. We go out and we hold public hearings throughout the state on all of our rulemaking issues. And the time that it takes, usually it's about a two-year period. Actually, in statute 14.1285 outlines an 18-month window to get rules done. And it states that if you're given specific rulemaking authority, you have 18 months to complete that. One of our major concerns is now with the LCC and proposed rules, what does that do to that piece of law? Several of our rulemaking processes that we've been working on, because we wanted to make sure that they were a public and open and a complete process, took longer than this, and those rulemakings were laid on the table because of not meeting that timeline. So that's an issue I hope that at some point in time we could discuss within this committee, is 18 months isn't enough to have a really good rulemaking process. So, but that issue aside, looking at the changes in Section 11, we do appreciate the repealer being removed, but the timeline, January 15th, 2013, to prepare this report from the DNR side of things, we have 45 different chapters of rules. It may take us longer than April 30th or whatever this law would go into effect to January 15th to get this done. We are working on the fiscal note that will outline those costs and those impacts for the Finance Committee, but the timeline is one of the things that we remain concerned about. And also just the fact that it seems like this bill, at least this section of it, is almost a problem in search for a solution. We would rather, or I should say a solution in search for a problem, we would rather spend time talking about rules that do have impacts or that people have concerns about related to specific issues. If there's a rule out there that people are viewing as impeding commerce or that is impeding job creation, let's talk about that now and do something about it while we can, rather than prepare all these reports, review reports, which will probably justify a lot of our rulemaking. I would be surprised if 10% of the rules that we would prepare and talk about would be identified as problems right now, probably a lot less. But we would rather, as an administration, talk about rules that need to be repealed, need to be reviewed, need to be tweaked, and do that while we have the chance, rather than prepare all these reports and go through that end of it. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, if I may add just one more point, and that is that many departments, including mine, my department, agriculture, we routinely get rid of obsolete rules and statutes. In fact, we have a little policy and technical bill that'll be traveling through the process this year that has a fairly large repealer with some obsolete and no longer needed rules and statutes that we are seeking to have repealed. The other point I wanted to make is that our rules at Ag have to change quickly sometimes because of changes in requirements from entities like the European Union or other international trade partners. And so I'm concerned that this process might impact that somehow. And in addition, our rulemaking is, I wanted to reiterate what Mr. Meyer said. Our rulemaking is very public and very open. Most of our rules are made either because of a federal requirement or in response to stakeholders who present the department with a need that we can try to assist them with. And I have a couple items in our policy bill this year similar in that situation. So with that, we would be happy to answer any questions, Mr.
Thank
Chairman.
You. Thank you. Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Meyer, I'd like to ask you, if one thing I was wondering about is if this bill went into effect, would it have any effect on the licensing, hunting, fishing, bear hunting, any of those issues that people depend on your department for?
Mr. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, the bill in its current form would not have that impact. We were talking about those on the rulemaking moratorium bill. But this bill has us reviewing those, all of our rules, and then the legislature preparing a report on what rules should be repealed or obsolete. Actually, you'll see it on lines 9.10 to 9.11. Each committee shall prepare a report by April 1st, 2013 to the legislature with draft legislation to sunset every rule that is obsolete, unnecessary, or duplicative of other state or federal statutes or rules, which is, as Ms. Gauthier was talking about, that is what the department does on an annual basis.
And Senator Goodwin.
Mr. Chair, and I don't care who answers this, but you said the process for getting rid of a rule meant that you had to come to the legislature and get it repealed. You can't do anything with the rules that are currently in law on your own without having to have them repealed.
Mr. Chair and committee members, there's two processes. You can go through rulemaking to take care of that, or you can go through the legislature. The MPCA, specifically this year, does have a number of rules that it's looking to repeal in its policy bill, and we've chosen the legislative route because of the speed it can be done compared to the cost and time of an actual rulemaking to go back and do that.
Okay, and then my final...
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My final question is, the only complaint I've heard about rules really is sometimes people say they didn't know the rules were they didn't know that, that the real process was beginning or whatever, and that's not a common complaint, but I have heard it. So two questions, really. One is, how well are they is that advertised? You know, I heard before that some rules were just advertised in the state register and hardly anybody reads that document, including me. But and then I know in some departments they do it differently. But is there any consistent process for making sure that people are aware that those rules are going to be made?
Ms. Gauthier.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Senator Goodwin. Yes, I believe most agencies, I know the people sitting at the table and some others, although I will admit I have not canvassed every single agency, but at Department of Ag, we have an extensive process. We take it very seriously. We have an internet. We have a website where it is made available there. We notify stakeholder groups that are interested, and usually we are working with the stakeholder groups from the start to craft our rules. However, we are a smaller agency than the other two here, so we have the ability to do that.
Thank you, Mr.
Senator Ortman.
Well, Senator Peterson, I thank you for your legislation, and I'm frustrated that I hear over and over again, with all due respect to you, Commissioner Meyer, that this is legislation in search of a problem. How many times have we heard that? I think on so many bills, and I think that this is about the proliferation of rules, and so I support Senator Peterson's efforts here, and I also think there's an effort here to restore oversight and improve accountability. We have too much rulemaking going on. We have too many administrative agencies that are passing and adopting rules that Minnesotans have to follow, and that those rules are becoming burdensome for Minnesotans and for our businesses. And this is what policymakers do. We set the policy. We try and determine an appropriate climate. And that's what we're trying to do, is put the connectivity back with the legislature to make sure that there's good oversight and there's accountability and that we don't have all this additional proliferation of rulemaking. And so I don't like hearing that. I'm just going to say I don't like hearing legislation in search of a problem. We're all here as policymakers to improve the state of Minnesota, and in this case, Senator Peterson's effort is, I think, a great effort to help Minnesotans succeed in their businesses and to keep the agencies from unnecessarily or even unwittingly getting in their way. So I think it's a great effort, and Senator Peterson, you have my support.
Are there any further testifiers to this bill? Senator Carlson? Oh, excuse me. Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, before the testifiers move, I had a couple of questions. I wanted to have a sense of, you know, the deadline. There is a sense of kind of the amount of time and effort that needs to go into the review. Clearly, I understand that this is an exercise that may just simply make you waste your time, and then you come back to us and submit a recommendation that you had in the past for rules, so the process is the same. But this time what we're asking is that you do it quickly and that you somehow put a public process in place to show the public that you're doing something different, because this is just an exercise, a public exercise. So how much is going to cost us if we go through each agency to do this public exercise, to do this expeditiously so that we have, you know, this in place, and then you submit a recommendation to us? Give us a sense of, you know, the amount of staff and time and money that will be used to do an exercise that is not needed.
Senator Torres Ray, this is going to be vetted in finance, which they will deal with the fiscal note. I think we've already heard them say that through what I would consider maybe not a lack of prioritization, they're not interested in moving too many people out of the jobs they're doing right now to do this. That's the testimony that I'm hearing here. So as far as the fiscal note aspect, I would just soon leave that for finance. If any of the testifiers would like to tell us how long it's going to take. I'm open to that in FTE hours, because you don't want to pull somebody off a different project that might not have the priority or the request from the legislature.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and thank you, Senator Torres-Ray. I believe there will be a fiscal note that's underway, and it's partially completed as of now. I believe that fiscal note already shows a number of FTEs. Was it 9.5, perhaps? Don't quote me. I'm not sure which version is available, but I think the point is that there was the statute was passed in 2000 requiring this kind of report, looking at all of our rules and which should be eliminated, and all the agencies complied with that over a period of years, I think, set forth in the initial statute up to 2004 or 5. So, I mean, this is something that goes ongoing all the time. If we had to produce this report, however, I can speak for my own agency that we have estimated it probably would be 4 or 5 additional full-time equivalents in order to prepare the report by the deadline. We have 22 chapters of rules, 600 pages. I can speak for my own agency, and I'm sure the others here could speak for theirs. It would be a lot of work.
Thank you. Any further discussion? Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move Senate File 1922 as amended be recommended to pass and be referred to the Committee on Finance.
Senator Wigger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate, Senator Peterson, your efforts to try to improve the bill, but I still believe it's not necessary. I'm concerned that I don't believe it serves the public's best interests. Rules are put in place.
Mr. Chair, is that to my motion?
I'm opposed.
I made the motion, Chair. I was just wondering if Senator Wieger's.
Yeah, to your motion.
Thank you. Yeah. Yes. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I oppose the bill because I don't believe it serves the public's best interests. There is a remedy in place to address unreasonable rules in 3.305. There is ongoing review of obsolete rules. There is a process where people can come before the legislature if they deem a rule inappropriate. And that is done. Oftentimes, a rule might be put in place in response to a death, an injury, something someone may have consumed, drank, that they ate, a workplace injury. I know, Senator Pearson, it's not your intent to put a moratorium on that type of thing, but it could happen. Where you have in here that five legislators could stop the process or intervene, I think you could probably find a following of 5 legislators on any particular issue. So I don't think that potentially serves the public's best interests. And with the cost that's involved, I know it's going to be reviewed at the next step, but I think it's a very good signal, Senator Peterson, that you're working to try to improve on this. But if we could target in on us, couple of specific items, but I would say fundamentally it's already in place in existing law.
Senator Carlson renews his motion that Senate File 1719 as amended be recommended to pass and or 1922 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
Aye.
Prevails. Thank you. Our next item on the agenda is Senate File 1719, Senator Hoffman, Motorcycle Road Guard Certificate Requirement. Members, this is a bill that was sent to us from the Transportation Committee. Our jurisdiction on the bill is strictly over the rulemaking provisions to the Department of Public Safety. Senator Hoffman, welcome, and I believe you have an amendment to the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I do. I have the A1 amendment.
To the A1 amendment.
The A1 amendment deals with some concerns that the police chiefs had, and this is what the House came up with as a compromise. And basically what this does is it deals with traffic light control and notification to the first-class cities. of the ride from the organizers, and then it gives a time frame for those notifications, and then for the cities to respond to the organizers, and then what will occur if they choose to not control the traffic lights as the rides are going through the cities.
All right. Any discussion on the A1 amendment? Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move the A1 amendment to Senate File 1719.
All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Amendment prevails. To the bill. Any discussion? Do you have a testifier, Senator Hoffman? If not, we can move forward.
Mr. Chair, if we could just get a minute of background on this.
Senator Hoffman, Senator Wigger would just like to have a brief background on this.
Sure, Mr. Chair, Senator Wigger. Basically, this bill was something that a number of motorcycle ride organizers asked for, and I even in my county, my county sheriff, my county highway, the Safe Streets Coalition came out in favor of this bill, and basically they're establishing a motorcycle road guard certificate. So during those large rides, I know personally, I remember talking about this in transportation, but I'll refresh your memory. My husband and I ride Harleys, and we go on some of these rides. And when you have 1,500 bikes rolling through a community, they put the traffic guards up to kind of direct traffic and make sure everybody gets to the community safe. So And especially in the rural parts of the state where these rides are prevalent, they're having to use law enforcement to do that, which stresses law enforcement. And if they get called away, then there are no road guards there. So this bill would actually set up a training program, set up a certificate, and then allow the organizers to have their people in place, much like what we do for the crossing guards for schools. And the part of the bill that we're here, I guess, today to talk about is just the rulemaking process. We saw this in transportation, or they saw it in transportation, and then some of the questions about what the department would deal with as far as the rules is what we've discussed today.
All right. Thank you very much, Senator Hoffman. Ms. McCormick, did you want to weigh in on this?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, Pat McCormick, the Director of Driver and Vehicle Services. And I just wanted to inform the committee that Driver and Vehicle Services would be the division within the Department of Public Safety that would be responsible for the rulemaking. And the rulemaking would take into account the curriculum for the program, a program approval, as well as specific issues related to liability, and also related to the regulations that would apply to people that were serving in these positions related to impairment and not a drop, those kinds of issues. And so that would be what the rulemaking would entail. And there would be it would be listed as a medium rulemaking, which is a $20,000 cost. And so that's what the fiscal note is about in terms of a cost for the rulemaking that would be necessary.
Thank you very much. Any discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Torres Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Hoffman, the bill refers to training. Who would be, who is responsible for doing the training? How would the training occur? How does the training occur? Is there any cost associated with the training?
Well, first and foremost, remember, we're dealing with the rulemaking process.
Oh, that's the rule. Okay.
Just a rule. But, Senator Hoffman, if you can answer real quick, who would be in charge of the training?
Well, Mr. Chair, I'm going to defer the question to the department.
Ms. McCormick.
Mr. Chair and Senator, the Office of Traffic Safety works with the Motorcycle Safety Center, and they would be the ones that would be working through MNSCU, and they would be the ones that would be in charge of the actual training. And I think Bill Schaefer with the Office of Traffic Safety is here if you want to discuss any details in terms of that.
I don't think that was the I think you answered the question where we want to go. Senator Cohen.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I just want to make sure I know what I'm voting for or against. Yeah. So.
Well, Senator, I'm just going to suggest one thing, because I remember when I first came to the legislature, I was told to read the bills before I came to committee. And I would just remind everybody, we are in a short session. We have a short time period. And not only do I like people being on time, but I like them to know what we're discussing here out unless there's changes. So that's on my part. That's on everybody's part. Because we do have this short window, and I want to make sure that we use the taxpayer dollars very wisely. And I think it's incumbent upon us to start that process with reviewing and knowing exactly what we're discussing when we come to committee. And I only bring that up because we started late here today, and to me that is doing a disservice to the testifiers and the citizens that show up. So that's the end of my soapbox, Senator Cohen.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I had another meeting, and obviously I'm not late for this bill. So my question to both Senator Hoffman and Ms. McCormick, one, does the department support the bill, and two, what's the position of the Police Association?
Ms. McCormick.
Senator, Mr. Chair, and Senator Cohen, the department hasn't taken a position on this bill, but we have worked with Senator Hoffman in terms of ensuring that we have it in a form that we are able to administer.
Senator Hoffman, can you answer the other part of Senator Cohen's question?
Mr. Chairman, just the Police and Peace Officers Association, I guess is what I'm right. Wondering.
Mr. Chair, Senator Cohen, they have expressed concern about the bill. They have told me in private they oppose the bill. I don't know if they're in the office and want to, or in the audience and want to testify against the bill. That would be up to them. I'm not going to speak for them, but they have privately talked with me. In fact, today they brought me some language for a proposed some language changes that I'm not ready to act on today. So I will stay with the amendment that I offered today. And when they were in my office a little bit ago, I told them that we would continue because I believe this bill has another stop before it would go to the floor.
Is there anyone from the Minnesota Peace and Police Officers Association that wants to give testimony? All right. Members, this bill will be stopping in finance, too, as well.
Mr.
Senator
Chairman?
Cohen, did you have more?
Mr. Chairman?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Senator Hoffman, I don't know if this is quite fair, then, to ask you to articulate hearsay objections to your bill, but if you're comfortable doing so, what kind of concerns have they expressed to you?
Senator Hoffman?
Mr. Chair, Senator Cohen, you're correct. I wouldn't be comfortable in paraphrasing what the MPPOA may or may not have said about the bill, and I'll let them speak for themselves.
Yeah. All right.
But Mr. Chair, we are talking with them, and we're trying to work some sort of an arrangement out with them where everybody can be as happy as they can possibly be.
Thank you. Senator Olson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Senator Hoffman or Ms. McCormick. The fee relating to rules here, the Commissioner of Public Safety shall assess a fee for each applicant for the motorcycle road guard certificate calculated to cover the commissioner's cost of establishing and administering the program. In the cost of establishing, would that encompass the rulemaking? So would the rulemaking costs have to be borne out and be part of the fee structure?
Ms. McCormick?
Mr. Chair and Senator Olson, that would be one way that you would be able to handle the costs associated with the rulemaking would be through the fee that would be collected.
Okay, thank you. But that language would encompass.
Thank you. Senator Goodwin?
Oh, Mr. Chair, I think this is more to the process here, and I would like to say that I'm kind of disappointed that we don't have a chance to discuss these bills like I think we need to do. And especially since this is a state government finance bill, this bill affects some of our agencies that we have oversight over. And last week it was the same thing. And I think that if these bills can't be heard properly in the amount of time we have for this session, then we should hold off on these bills until we do have time to hear them. Because there's a lot of information. I can read the bills before your meeting, but I can't get my answers until I have the author here for the things that I'm not sure of. So I just really hope that we leave a little more time for these bills and do get a chance to hear them, because we don't hear them in finance. I said that last week. I'm saying it again. We do not hear policy issues in finance. So when it comes down to it, we're going to have to hear it in here. So please allow us some time. I'm just requesting that of you. Please allow us some time for people to come and testify.
Senator Ortman?
Mr. Chair, just a question. When was this bill put on the agenda? When was the agenda noticed, I guess, is a better question.
Either Friday morning or Thursday. It was
Thursday morning.
Thursday morning last week.
And Mr. Chair, that's my point. That's actually pretty good notice for folks about what's coming up. I get those notices from our committee administrators about what bills are coming up. I actually got phone calls and returned phone calls on this bill. There's been plenty of time for legislators to do their due diligence, and if there was a concern, there are lots of people around this Capitol that will answer any question you have. It's one of the great luxuries of being here. There are all kinds of people that will come to provide any information you could want. I think it's a reasonable thing for the chair to give a reasonable amount of time for discussion among committee members, for consideration of amendments, and then to move these bills. I think we all should be prepared to vote when there's been a reasonable amount of time for that, and I think that the chair has provided that this time and every other time as far as I've seen.
Senator Cohen, I think I saw your
hand
up.
To that point, Mr. Chair.
Excuse me, Senator Cohen. Senator Goodwin.
That's fine, Senator Ortman, Mr. Chair, and Senator Ortman, that's fine, but we can't talk to or find out who's going to be testifying until we get here. We cannot talk to people that may or may not be interested in these bills until we get here. This is where the public airing is. No matter if we read this bill 40 times and talk to different people, this is where the public airing of bills is supposed to take place. And if we really care about what the public thinks, we'll have full hearings on these bills.
And just to follow up, Senator Goodwin, sometimes we don't know who are going to testify, and that's why I give them the lenience. Like, I didn't realize Ms. McCormick was going to be here either today. So, Senator Cohen, then we're going to a vote.
Okay. And, Mr. Chairman, I don't want to get in the way of passing as much legislation as we can, all sorts of bills. And Senator Ortman, see, that the people don't hang around the state office building as much, though. I've learned that. They're more likely to be here at the Capitol. So I've learned that's a difference. But let me just ask, Mr. Chairman, a quick question to Senator Hoffman. Just looking at the bill. Just a hypothetical, and maybe it's just if you've been involved with some of the bike rides, this might have no substance at all, but since I'm not, I've not done this. What happens is, could there hypothetically be a situation where looking at the amendment that we just adopted, that a city has not cooperated with a ride organizer, and so under the proposed bill, then the person who is the motorcycle guard, or I'm not sure what the road guard, then is able to direct traffic. What happens if there's an emergency that takes place, and the police of whatever city or town show up and say, we don't care? Is there any, I'm not, like I said, this might be a hypothetical that just is not grounded in reality, but is there any chance that the guard would have the authority to trump a police officer in that kind of a situation?
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senator Cohen, I can't imagine that would be the case. And I have not organized one of these rides, but I have participated in them. And the goal of the organizers and those of us who ride on a two-wheel bike, we want to get through safely, and we also want to make sure that the people that need to get through those intersections are getting through safely. That's why we want these guards present. If we're on a ride and 1,500 bikes are going through an intersection and the police or the sheriff get called away, there's nobody guarding those intersections. I happen to know in my county that my people support this because it does stress their budgets. And so they would sooner have somebody there that understands about traffic control and moving these bikes through and stopping the bikes if for some reason emergency vehicles would have to get through. So I cannot speak for the organizers or the police. This is that's my opinion being a part of those rides.
Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, I move the adoption of the bill and that we send it to the Finance Committee.
All right. Senator Ortman moves that Senate File 1719 be recommended to pass as amended, to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. Any further discussion? If not, all those. Senator Torres-Ray.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to leave on the record that it is very difficult for me to vote on these bills. I do believe that you are limiting our opportunity to have a discussion about these bills. If finance is going to go over these bills, let finance take care of the policy piece. I want to leave on the record that I feel uncomfortable with having a discussion about a bill, about a policy bill, and voting on a policy issue without having ample discussion. I would like to have the authors of these bills bring testifiers that speak to the issues so that I can vote on these issues with ample information. And I don't believe that the committee is allowing that. So I want to leave that on the record.
Senator Ortman.
And Mr. Chair, for the record, did you not ask if there was anybody here from the public that would like to testify? And did you not accommodate anybody that wanted to testify on this bill?
Senator Ortman, I did.
I renew my motion, Mr. Chair.
You renew your motion that Senate File 1719 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
Aye.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Hoffman. Thank you, Ms. McCormick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members.
Third item on the agenda is Senate File 1918, Senator Chamberlain. Energy forward pricing mechanisms for the government agencies provisions modifications. Senator Chamberlain, welcome, and I believe you have an author's amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. I do have an author's amendment.
Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, I move the A1 amendment to Senate File 1918.
All those in favor of the A1 amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Amendment prevails. Senator Chamberlain.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Cohen.
If you'll allow me just to offer a suggestion, I'm following up on Senator Hoffman's bill, but I think what gets a little bit confusing for us is where we've combined the policy and the finance jurisdiction, and we're trying to keep this track of this bill, you know, bill by bill. Maybe if an author appears in front of us where there was an extensive policy conversation in a preceding committee, if we can just know that at the front end, that might be of some assurance to us.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Chamberlain.
Mr. Chair, thank you. It's good to be back. Quickly, what we have here is this bill will help expand the use of energy forward contract pricing mechanisms to all state, from all state agencies to all government agencies, local up to the state. The primary purpose of this is it's an optional way to reduce budget risk. It also expands the type of fuel, the amount of energy covered, and establishes an oversight mechanism. This adds unleaded fuel types to the covered energy. In its current form, it strikes the exception to exclusion of electricity. It defines government agencies as the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities, the University of Minnesota, statutory or home rule charter cities, counties, towns, school districts, regional agencies, or other political subdivisions. It expands the amount of energy affected by the mechanism from 90% to 100% of the agency's use over a period of 48 months. And it requires each agency using energy forward pricing to establish an oversight process with audit review in a manner prescribed by the state auditor. It also repeals the previously there was a component in here to cover just Hennepin County and the Met Council, so that has been repealed. In short, this helps control budget risk by estimating costs, fixing costs, and also stability by controlling the volatility in the energy market. And with me are Mr. Lemunyan. This bill was brought forward by Mr. Lemunyan last year to Representative Downey in the House, so I was fortunate enough to pick it up. I think it's a great idea. It improves flexibility and gives the local government agencies some more options to help control their budget risk and stabilize the fuel cost. So Mr. Lemunyan has a brief overview of what we're looking at, and then Mr. Bertelson is from the U of M, and he'll give you a short overview of how it can positively impact costs for these agencies.
Welcome, Mr. Lemunyan. Please state your name, and then you may proceed.
Jeffrey Lemunyan, and thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. This piece of legislation would enable public entities in Minnesota to engage in energy price risk management. My company, Linwood Capital, has been engaged in this area of advisory for the past 15 years, and currently we price roughly $250 million worth of petroleum fuels on an annual basis. The basics of what we're talking about here, can fuel costs be controlled? The answer is yes, they can through forward pricing. This is nothing more than establishing the price today for a fuel that's going to be consumed at some later date. The results of forward pricing is lower fuel budget risk for the entity that is doing this, a higher certainty of future fuel costs, lower fuel cost volatility. And the main point is that the daily fuel market will no longer determine what their cost is, but they have the availability and the option of doing that in advance. This applies to gasoline, diesel, and natural gas, and has financial results, and I'll get into that in a minute. And the reason why it works is because the financial instruments that are used to hedge the fuels have a very high mathematical correlation to the price and the cost of the fuel that the entity is experiencing. And so this is a chart right here showing the blue line is the actual diesel cost. The pink line is the futures price. And you, as you can see, they move in the same direction at the same time and in the same way, making it a good hedge. And I'll talk about what that is in a minute. But essentially what that means is that if you lock in your fuel price at $3 a gallon today, prices go up a dollar a gallon, you still pay a dollar to your supplier, but the financial instrument will pay you a dollar, making your net cost at $3. If it goes the other way, the opposite will happen. The effects, as I mentioned, on of hedging is to reduce budget risk and reduce the uncertainty of future costs. This is a graph showing a forward pricing curve. And in the futures markets, there are prices associated with each time period into the future. The pink and yellow lines on the left-hand side show the expected range of cost for petroleum fuel into the future and the range of that cost. So what this means is that the graph in the middle, or I'm sorry, the graph on the left, shows that 1 year forward, the expected cost is roughly $2.25 per gallon, and it has an expected range. It could range anywhere from roughly $1.25 to $3.25. Unfortunately, this is an old graph, and this is not what we're doing today. On the right-hand side, we see a graph of a position that is 90% hedged. It's the same blue line, same cost expectation, but the variability or uncertainty of that cost is much less than it would be without the hedging. So what this means is, looking at this graph, is that if a public entity, say a school board or something along those lines, were 90% hedged and prices at the pump went up by a dollar a gallon, their costs would only go up by 10 cents per gallon. So this is advantageous to the public entity. Better planning, budgeting, and forecasting. They have some idea as what their fuel costs are going to be into the future. More efficient capital structure. They are no longer needing to set aside as much cash as might be otherwise the case in the case of higher fuel costs. And it increases overall organizational efficiency because if fuel prices rise to pass the budget, there would be someone whose attention in that organization would be diverted to solve that problem. Public entities are especially subjected to fuel price risk. There are no shareholders that can absorb higher cost. Difficult to pass along to the customers, raising the fare on kindergartners to get to school is probably not going to be a popular thing. And public entities do not compete with other organizations. There's no competitive processes here, unlike an airline industry where hedging would introduce some competitive advantages and disadvantages. That is not the case with fuel hedging by public entities. This is an example of how forward pricing works over time. This is a 10-year example. The blue line shows us the spot price for diesel fuel over a 10-year period, and as you can see, the spike in 2008, and then prices, because of the financial crisis, going very low in early 2009. The pink price or the pink line shows us that the cost of fuel net of the hedge, and so this graph is to illustrate that there are periods of time when the hedge pays you, and other periods of time where you pay the hedge. And so this is also to illustrate that over the long term, the expectation is that the realized benefit and realized costs will add up to zero, and that the benefit that you get along the way is having the budget certainty. Several examples, the mechanics of how this works. In this example, the fuel budget is $2.60 per gallon, but because of market conditions, the actual cost from the supplier is $3 per gallon for this particular month. This entity in the example burns 300,000 gallons, so they will pay their supplier $900,000. Fortunately for this entity, they accumulated six forward pricing contracts, accounting for 252,000 of the 300,000 that they purchased. And they did that. They made those contracts at an average cost of $2.50 per gallon. The contract or the price now is $3 a gallon, so the realized gain on the financial instrument is 50 cents a gallon on 252,000 gallons, or $126,000. That is what the contract pays them, so their net fuel cost is $774,000, or $2.58 per gallon, and they are within their fuel budget. If prices move down, the opposite happens. Prices here in this example move down to $2 per gallon. They pay their fuel supplier $600,000. They have a net loss of 50 cents per gallon on their hedge, so they pay the hedge $126,000. Their net fuel cost is $726,000. So what this means is that as prices move up, the hedge pays you, and if prices move down, you pay the hedge. You have certainty of future fuel costs, and over the long term, it's a great benefit for public entities. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Lemonyan, what's the average length of these contracts? Is there are they 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years out, or
they are available in terms of 42,000 gallons per contract, and the contracts are made on a monthly basis. So you can, for instance, hedge 42,000 gallons for July of 2013, and you can do that today for that particular month. So it's very flexible how it's built.
Is there an average percentage where the hedge fund pays you as opposed to where you pay the hedge fund? Is there, over time, is there an average, or does it pretty much just level out to zero?
Mr. Chairman, that will depend on when you start the program and when you stop. The expectation is that if you can improve upon it adding or it resulting in zero, then you do so, and that can be done by astutely timing the transactions when things are relatively good as opposed to when they're not, making your forward pricing at those times. But the general expectation would be that over a very long period of time, that it would average out to zero, and that the valuable benefit that you get along the way is having the budget certainty and the certainty of future fuel cost.
You emphasize that word astutely pretty strong.
It's important.
Our next testifier, if you would, please state your name and proceed.
Sure. My name is Michael Bertelson. I'm Associate Vice President for Facilities Management on the Twin Cities campus of the University of Minnesota. And apology, we had first been brought in on the House bill last year, and then the bill all of a sudden kind of picked up this session. So this is still a presentation from last year, and I can speak to what the numbers are changes since then. Second thing is we're here neither to support or oppose the bill, just as an example of how it's been done, and this practice has been used by a public institution. So just to give a short couple of points about it, the University of Minnesota, first of all, is certainly a large facility, 28 million gross square feet, many technical campus facilities across many multiple campuses across the state. For the Twin Cities campus itself, on page 3, our natural gas fuel, and this is the only thing that we have used this practice for, our natural gas purchases. Our total fuel cost to heat the campus and provide chilled water is about $14.5 million, the vast majority of that being natural gas, and that's what led us to this conversation. You can see on page 4 the historical, much like the earlier presentation you saw. For us, the market volatility for natural gas has been really quite dramatic. over the last decade or so. And so looking at that volatility, that certainly made it difficult for us to plan or to budget, and how do we pass those costs on to other colleges within the university? So when we put together the strategy, we looked at as a goal, how do we manage risk from a price volatility? We put together protocols and a purchasing plan to establish guidelines and purchasing decisions, as we'd have several layers of overview and oversight. We have a cross-functional team of people in energy management, the Office of Investment and Banking, who understand this, the tools and the implications of financial hedging. And we work routinely, meet routinely, and we also have hired and utilize market expertise to help oversight, give us advice on the market and execution. And finally, from an outcome perspective on slide six, you can see that over time, certainly as the markets are going up or down, the impact of that financially will be certainly different. Through 2002 through 2009, you can see that we've had savings. The last, more recently, when the prices of natural gas have been plummeting, which is a good thing for the gas we buy on the market, on the spot, but that it, we have been in the last 12 months or so, with the amount that we've hedged, we have been, as Mr. Lemonian pointed out, paying the hedge. Not so much, but we still achieved the other price certainty goals that we had achieved.
Thank you. Any questions for these testifiers?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Wigger.
Yes, I think it's a great bill. Just a question on whether there might be multi-state compacts for purchasing and whether we would want to entertain legislation that would allow that, or maybe you can do it. I was thinking of when Governor Pawlenty had issued the challenge for this type of cooperation to encourage, you know, greater efficiency and savings.
Mr. Lemonian, do you have any comment on that?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This is what's being proposed here is for the pricing of the fuel and not necessarily for the purchasing of the fuel. So I'm not familiar with any multi-state cooperatives that would purchase the fuel. This is more hedging the price of the fuel and mitigating the financial impact of volatile fuel markets for public entities.
Thank you.
Yeah,
Senator Wigger?
So, Ms. Chair, I'm aware of that. I just thought maybe this might be an opportunity to explore that further. And then I had another question that I believe Senator Olson is looking into right now as to school districts you have in here, but whether charter schools would be included in that definition.
Senator Chamberlain?
I should get here.
Excuse
more
me. Often. I was waiting because I was waiting. Senator, I wanted to say Olson, but she hadn't quit talking. Senator Olson. Are you making that as a motion, Senator Olson, or?
Is that sound like it's reasonable?
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I wouldn't have a problem with it. This is an optional. The bill makes this optional for these entities to engage in this, and you know, if the entity gets too small, it's not advantageous to do it. But I'm not opposed to doing that.
All right. Could we have staff here? Senator Olson has an oral amendment to add charter schools. Where would be the appropriate place?
On line 1.14, Mr. Chair and members, after a school district comma, you could insert charter schools, or if there's a better phrase that those of you who are familiar with education topics would suggest.
Senator Olson, is that what you're looking at?
Well, they are public schools, and for some purposes, they are included as they're considered a school district or part of a school district. So if I would just say including charter schools.
a school district, comma, including charter schools. Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Wigger.
How about after a school district, comma, a charter school, comma?
Okay. It's,
right.
Either way, if we find that it's not necessary, we'll
right. All right, to Senator Olson's oral amendment to Senate File 1918. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All same sign. Amendment prevails. Any further discussion on the bill?
Can I ask
any further testimony, too? If you would like to testify, please come forward. Senator Goodwin.
I just have a simple question, Mr. Chair. I wanted to know why we need a bill to do this. They can't do it now, or what? Is there a law preventing it, or what?
Senator Chamberlain.
Mr. Chair, Senator Goodwin, it makes it clear that they can. There was some confusion in the past that because they weren't specifically listed in here that they didn't want to go into that territory. So this makes it clear that they do have that ability now. And the bill also adds a couple things like unleaded fuel and cleans up a couple other areas, like repealing the obsolete language with Hennepin County Met Council.
Okay. Thank you.
All right. Please state your name and proceed.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Rick Evans. I'm with XL Energy. And I'd like to just speak very briefly to one small portion of the bill. On line 1.7, the bill strikes the language except electricity used in state operations, which appears to allow electricity then to become a part of the energy that would be traded. This is as the committee probably knows, electric utilities are highly regulated in the state of Minnesota. One of the things that we have as a part of our regulatory compact is that we sell our energy in exclusive service territories where the utility and only the incumbent utility is permitted to sell electricity. The other side of that equation is that we don't have the option of denying anyone electricity. If you're in our service territory, you're entitled to be served by us. This provision at least implies that a customer would be able to purchase electricity outside of the service territory. Now, there's nothing necessarily wrong with that, except that it takes the entire regulatory scheme in Minnesota and upsets it in significant and important ways. I don't want to take the time of the committee to describe all the ways that violating the service territory would make it remarkably difficult to operate utilities in the way that we do in the state, but let me just mention one example. I'm assuming the state agency that takes advantage of this and goes out and is somehow able to purchase electricity from some other source would want to deliver it to their building, which means there's got to be a wire connected to their building. That wire is owned by XL Energy. That wire goes to a pole, which is also owned by XL Energy, and hooks into a distribution grid, which is also owned by XL Energy. This is, of course, true in our service territory. In a co-op service territory or any of the other utilities, the wires and the poles would be owned by the incumbent utility. Those wires then go to a transmission grid, which is also owned by XL Energy, and then connected to the generation system. All of that infrastructure is a fixed cost. It doesn't go down just because the public entity has gone and purchased their energy somewhere else. And yet the only way the utility pays for those fixed costs, pays to keep them in repair and keep them operating, is through the rates that are set by the Public Utilities Commission. So imagine a customer that was able to use forward pricing and purchase 100% of their energy from some other source. Are they going to be using XL's wires for free? Are they going to use the poles for free? Are they going to use the transmission grid for free? Nothing is free, as you know, so that means all of the other customers who aren't taking advantage of forward pricing are going to have to pay for that stuff. That's just one element of a very complicated set of regulations that we have that govern electricity utilities in the state of Minnesota. And while it would be great to have a terrific conversation about deregulation, we started that a few years ago and then ended it, we could start that up again. My point is you can't deregulate one small part of the system and expect the rest of the system to operate. Our customers who are residential customers, for example, or our small business customers, or our large commercial industrial customers who aren't able to take advantage of forward pricing in electricity would end up having to pay for all of the fixed costs that were not going to be paid for by a customer that is buying their electricity from somewhere outside of our service territory. Imagine again that they're buying 100% of their energy. Are they going to build their own transmission system? Are they going to build their own distribution system? Are they going to build the wire to their building to provide that electricity? I suspect not. I suspect they're going to want to use ours, but they're not going to be paying for it. So I don't understand the rest of this bill. I take it that the traders know what they're doing and all of that. I'd like to continue our conversation with the author and the committee to make sure that we don't disrupt the electric utility regulatory scheme while we're doing this.
Did you say it was Mr. Evans?
Yes, sir.
I would say that there's probably going to be some spirited debate when this moves on to the next committee, which just happens to be energy, utilities, and telecommunications on that.
Senator thank you, Mr. Chamberlain. Chair, I wasn't aware of that. So.
Yeah, Senator Chamberlain.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair, and I thank him for his comments. They brought it to my attention this morning, so I'm not necessarily opposed to removing it, but considering it was just this morning, I wanted more time to consider all the options and the impact on either side. So when it goes to energy, I'm not opposed to looking at it and having it taken care of there.
Thank you, Mr. Emmons. Senator Olson. Senator Chamberlain.
Mr. Chair, Senator Olson, I had discussed it earlier, but I guess I don't recall. Do you, Mr. Lemonian?
I don't.
Yeah. All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Any further testifier? Senator Goodwin.
Thank you. Just one quick question, Mr. Chair and Senator Chamberlain. Has any of this language gone before the Public Utilities Commission? And if it hasn't, shouldn't they be discussing this so we know all the ramifications?
Senator Chamberlain.
Mr. Chair and Senator Goodwin. No, I don't believe it has been in front of PUC, and if once this goes over to energy and we remove that out of there, I think we should be fine.
All right. Any further testimony? Senator Thompson?
I move that Senate File 1918 as amended be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Energy, Utilities, and Telecommunications.
To that motion, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Chamberlain. Senator Lilly is up next.
It's been a pleasure.
The final item on our agenda is House File 1766, Child Care Assistance Fund Payments, Union Dues, or Fair Share Fees Deduction Prohibition. We do have a list of testifiers here. Also, members. There is written testimony in the folders that you have in front of you. And if we do have, I believe our first testifier, I think, will be Jennifer Parrish, followed by Heather Falk. If you two would like to come up to the table with Senator Lilly, feel free to do so. Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you very much. House File 1766 is a Child Care Assistance Funds Protection Act, and this bill is in response to Governor Mark Dayton's recent executive order calling for a vote on unionization of private, independent, in-home child care providers. On December 5th, 2011, a temporary restraining order was issued blocking the governor's unionization vote that was scheduled to begin on December 7th of 2011. The summary judgment hearing was held on February 22nd, and Judge Lindemann will rule on that in about 90 days. Currently, federal law does not allow the payment of union dues or other fees from child care subsidies that are provided federally, but the state lacks such a statute. So this creates a significant loophole should Governor Dayton's order lead to the unionization of licensed and legal non-licensed child care providers in Minnesota. In other words, there is nothing in the existing state law to stop unions from capturing taxpayer dollars that are intended for the care of our children. The bill is very simple. It makes it so that union dues or fair share fees may not be deducted from child care assistance payment funds directly. This bill ensures that child care assistance dollars are applied directly to the care of children instead of being diverted to unions. The bill establishes a layer of protection to maintain the integrity of child care assistance program money, dollars. Our bill simply protects the money that is meant for our children and keeps it from going directly to unions. When we protect these funds, We also act as faithful stewards of the taxpayers' dollars. And we have testifiers here to talk about the bill also.
Thank you very much. Please state your name, and you may proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Heather Falk. I've been a child care provider in Cloquet, Minnesota for 10 years. I've heard this bill through the other three committees, and the one thing that I keep hearing from my lawmakers are some confusion on what CCAP is. CCAP is the Child Care Assistance Program. It's a family benefit applied for by the family to assist them in paying for child care. State Statute 19B.03 says child care assistance provided through the child care funds is considered assistance to the parent. I am not an employee, and I do not receive a paycheck. I offer a service as an individual small business, much like a contractor, independent contractor like a hairdresser or a grocery store owner. As with 19B and the executive order, we are not considered employees of the state or county by receiving these funds. CCAP funds are just like private pay funds, and what I mean by this is nothing can be deducted from these payments. Taxes are not deducted from these payments. Charity is not deducted from these payments. My bills are not deducted from these payments until they are in my bank account and become my funds to spend however I choose. Imagine if your child care provider asked you for your banking information so that her mortgage payment could be automatically withdrawn from your account. The money in your account, after all, will eventually become hers, and you can just issue her a check for the remainder of your child care bill. The other thing I'm hearing from lawmakers is that this bill is a horse before the cart. As a child care provider, I am out there talking to other child care providers, and I can tell you that this is a current and real issue. I really dislike having to bring up the union part, but it does apply. Providers already do not want to accept CCAP families because of the threat of unionization. The unions have openly stated that they will not give up on creating a union here in Minnesota. In the December 6th AskMe teleconference, AskMe stated they had been fighting for a union in California for 12 years, and they hadn't given up there, and they won't give up here in Minnesota, even if it's struck down in court or if they were to lose the election. This threat is very real to my business and to many others. You might think that not accepting CCAP at this point is a little early, but as a child care provider, we love the children we care for. We get attached to them and their families. We do not want to make those attachments and be forced to let those families go or be forced to pay fees, putting those families under more financial strain. I have a letter in your packet from one of my child care families who's on the program, and she made a call to 33 of the 35 in our town child care providers to see who will continue to accept CCAP funds if dues are deducted. She found that only four will continue. I've talked with other providers who have already said they've stopped, two just in the last week, accepting CCAP families. The executive order brought us here. The unions won't tell us what to expect, but ask us to look into other states for the wonderful things that they have done. With that same logic, we have to look at facts from those states. And in nine states, according to AskMe's attorney, Mr. Corwin, the executive orders are all exactly the same. Yet after the union gets a contract, additional statutes are issued to collect fees from the CCAP funds. In your packet is information put together by Jennifer, and she'll touch on that a little bit more. I urge you to support this bill because it is not an anti-union bill. CCAP recipients are, after all, not the ones being organized. It does not say we cannot collectively bargain. It does not say the union cannot collect dues or fees. It simply protects low-income families from additional financial burden. And more importantly, it protects low-income families' access to quality licensed family child care. Families should have the right and the ability to select where they want to bring their children to, not forced into a situation on who will accept my children. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Please state your name. You may proceed.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Jennifer Parrish, and I'm a licensed family child care provider from Rochester. I'm here today to testify in support of House File 1766, and I also wanted to take a moment to thank Senator Lilly and Representative Lohmer for bringing this legislation forward. Child care providers across the state have been asking for this legislation since we first learned of the impending executive order last spring, and we appreciate our legislators listening to our concerns and addressing them with this bill. Like Heather, I would like to address some of the misconceptions regarding this bill. First, there are some who believe that this bill tells providers how they can and cannot spend their money. This is inaccurate. a provider can spend his or her money however they see fit. If a provider wants to join a union and pay dues, which can be done right now, they can do that, and this bill will not change that. However, the money must come from the provider and not from the subsidy program. Some have said that this bill will make it harder for providers to pay dues, and this is also not true. It does not get easier than the existing current auto-pay system that the unions already have in place. You simply check a couple of boxes and include a voided check or a credit card number, and you're done. They automatically take your dues every month. The biggest misconception, however, is that this bill is unnecessary, that it's a solution looking for a problem. So for those who do not see the problem, I put together some information and each of you should have a packet of information or a little thing of information in your packets. I've provided you with excerpts and links to the contracts reached in every other state where the child care providers have been unionized. Out of the 15 states that have done this, only 11 of them have reached some type of a contract or memorandum of understanding, which has enabled them to start collecting dues and fees. In each contract, you will see that the only method of union dues and fees deduction is through the state subsidy program. I was also told by a member of the governor's staff on November 11th, Michelle Helgen, that there was discussion that the state would withhold the dues here in Minnesota as well. The only place that the state can withhold dues is through the subsidy program. So this is the plan for providers in Minnesota. Even more concerning to us is that out of the 11 states that have reached a contract, 8 of them have assessed fair share fees to non-members, even though many of the initial executive orders didn't authorize it. These fair share fees were taken directly out of the subsidy payments before they were sent to providers. Out of the 3 states that did not assess fair share fees, 2 of them were right-to-work states, and in Wisconsin, the state statute didn't allow it. Every single state where they have been legally able to do so, they have deducted a fair share fee directly out of the subsidy payments. Regardless of what the governor's executive order says or does not say, child care providers are well aware that both AFSCME and SEIU believe that everyone covered by a contract should pay a fair share fee, and if the union wins an election, every provider who has a child on CCAP will be exclusively represented by SEIU or AFSCME and covered by any contract that they reach. So even though there is no union right now, the fear of compulsory fees is real enough that some child care providers have already stopped accepting CCAP families. The choices for low-income families are already being limited. This is the problem, and it's real, and it's happening right now. This problem is looking for a solution, and the solution is this bill. And if anyone is still thinking that this legislation is premature, I ask you to look to the child care providers in Michigan. Their legislature was not proactive in protecting the child care assistance program, probably because they didn't think it was necessary either. By the time the providers there got the state to stop taking dues and fees out of their subsidy checks, the union had already taken nearly $4.5 million from the providers. And now those providers are faced with trying to recoup those funds, and it is proving to be difficult. I'm urging you to not allow this to happen here. Please do not wait until it's too late to see that this is a problem. Don't put child care providers here in a position of having to recoup fees after the fact. None of you can guarantee providers that there will not be fair share fees, and so many of us believe that this will happen. If for no other reason, I urge you to pass this legislation just to give child care providers the peace of mind that they need to continue accepting families on CCAP. These families should not have to suffer or have their options limited because of something that has nothing to do with them. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is Addie Clyde here? And Judy Sanda, is it? Please state your name and proceed.
Okay, my name is Addie Clyde. Mr. Chairman and committee members, thank you for the opportunity of sharing in favor of Bill 1766. My name is Addie Clyde, and I have been a child care provider in Carleton County for 18 years. And I love my job so dearly that when someone asked my husband when I might retire, he answered, "I do not think she ever will. I think the last group of children will be the pallbearers that take her out." Bill is so important to me that I hired 2 people to come in my daycare for the day so that I could testify. I am also the president of Carleton County Licensed Child Care Association for the last 16 years. In this position, I have heard many providers say that if union dues are taken out of CAP checks, they will no longer take CAP children. I feel this will limit choices that our most vulnerable children have to find quality care and jeopardize the right for parents to choose and keep the provider of their choice. The whole point of daycare assistance is to help families afford quality care for their children. I charge a flat fee, and whatever is not covered from the cap check is covered by my parents. This is the parents' money. If the union wants money from me, they need to take it out of my bank account and not out of my parents' checks. Is it the place of the county to collect money for the union or to help low-income parents to afford quality care? Thank you for your time and for listening to my concerns, and I encourage you to pass Bill 1766 and protect the money that is set aside for low-income children.
Thank you. Please state your name and proceed.
I am Judy Sanda. Mr. Chair, see, I always forget the order. You guys make me nervous. People for years have said I could never do your job. I'll tell you this, I could never do yours. Thank you for the opportunity of being here. I have done daycare for over 32 years with over 300 children coming through my doors. And I also love my job. I have a college degree, and as a C3 licensed daycare provider, I urge you to support number 1766. I've been doing child care for so long that I remember when CAP monies were sent directly to the parents, who then paid us from their pockets. We at that time, 15 or so years ago, lobbied you, the legislature, to have those funds directed to us, the providers, to ensure that the state and federal funds were being allocated for child care. I am one of 8,500 licensed child care providers willing to accept families who receive financial assistance through the CAP program. I have 4 children out of my 14 who receive CAP payments right now. The largest number of children that I've had receiving CAP payments at one time is 7. If the union enters into my independent small business through dues or fees collected via my CAP payments, my licensed family child care program may be one less option for parents looking for quality child care. Please support number 1766. I could keep trying to read this, but it'd be best if I had my glasses.
Stress causes blindness.
Yeah, that's there we go.
Thank you very much. Any questions?
There, I have one.
Senator Goodwin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question now. When I talk to AFSCME and SEIU, they have promised me that people that didn't want to be in the union wouldn't have to be in the union, and they wouldn't have to pay either full share or fair share for it. So,
I'm ready to give my chair.
Okay.
To one of these
ladies. So that's, I mean, I've had them lie to me before, so I would expect that would be the case, but I'm just wondering.
Yeah, I'm sorry about
excuse
that.
Excuse me. Ms. Parrish.
Sorry. According to the governor's executive order, if the union should win the election, they will represent all licensed, registered, subsidized child care providers. So those providers, whether they choose to join AFSCME or SEIU or not, will be part of that union. And both AFSCME and SEIU are very open that they believe anyone covered by a union contract should pay their fair share. So we believe that it's only a matter of time, as I stated earlier, out of the 11 states that have a contract, every state where they have been legally able to do so, they have collected a fair share. And in fact, in Wisconsin, where they weren't able to do so, they have an area in their contract where it states that if the law ever changes, they will immediately meet and negotiate a fair share. So we know that that's their intent. That's what they want. Unfortunately, they don't have a whole lot of provider support here. And with the organizers that they've hired and the people that they've hired to run these unions, they can't even pay the salaries based on what they have in voluntary membership, people willing to pay dues. So eventually that's where they're headed. That's what they'd like to see. So even if it's not going to happen immediately, that's where they're headed.
All right. Are there any other testifiers here? Are there any other testifiers? Senator Olson.
Find out what fair share meant. And I don't know if you examined that statute, but for the life of me,
cover and how they determine it, other than in the statute says it can't exceed 85%, and lo and behold, they all charge 85%.
Yeah.
Sounds like another item for another day. All right, Senator Lilly.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move that House File 1766 be recommended to pass and move to the floor.
On that motion, all in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you very much, Senator Lilly. Being there is no further business before this committee, we are hereby adjourned. Thank you.